The war against illegal drugs is far from over.
You know, United Nations, if you can say one bad thing about me, I can give you 10. But the percussions, I don't give a shit to them.
I'll give a warning to Canada maybe next week. We'll declare war against them.
Hi, I'm Alec Rahino, Editor-in-Chief of the McGill International Review. On this special edition of Reviews Radio, I talk with Dr. Nicole Curuto about the Philippines' authoritarian turn and the results of the 2019 midterms. I met with Dr. Nicole Curuto on a cloudy day in the middle of July at a quiet corner at the Cabao Expo in the Philippines. She was in the country for a few days to take part in the CNN coverage of President Rodrigo Duterte's State of the Nation address. Dr. Curuto sandwiched me in during her busy week, right before Congress convened. I wanted to thank Nicole for taking the time to meet with me, and I hope you benefit from listening to her perspective.
I wanted to start broadly and just unpack the Philippines' last election cycle. So midterms are often used as a check to a president's power, but as we saw in May, Duterte essentially consolidated control of all the branches of government, and a lot of his allies won in national and local elections. What does this victory mean for the administration going forward?
Right. There are two schools of thought to answer that question. One school of thought is precisely what you mentioned. This is the consolidation of the strongman's power. It's the first time in recent history that no politician from the opposition won a Senate seat. And that is indeed troubling because there's the expectation that when you have a very strong executive, your safeguard for democracy would be an independent legislature and an independent judiciary. So what are the implications if you have a supermajority in Congress and in Senate? So a lot of possibilities can happen. Duterte can railroad his pet projects like federalism, death penalty. So that raises red flags because these are big institutional reforms. And you need a robust debate to make it work. But if you have a rubber stamp Senate and Congress, then that's definitely problematic. But the other school of thought, which I sort of subscribe to, is the idea that Congress and Senate is always fragmented. These are politicians who always look after their own personal self-interest. And there's a reason why 3 years into Duterte's presidency, charter change still has not happened, federalism hasn't happened, death penalty still not reimposed. And that's because these politicians know that they have to support the president, but also know that the president's power will not last forever. So I think to a certain extent, this self-interest is one thing that protects the country from just having a very strong executive. But it's kind of hard to make predictions because this new Congress hasn't convened yet as of today. It's definitely more worth monitoring what Duterte does and what the senators do with their supermajority.
And for the opposition that ran against Duterte, Ocho Derecho, in particular, comes to line.
Yeah.
A lot of them centered their campaign around directing attention towards the administration's brutal war on drugs and kind of, let's say, stretching himself as this resistance against Duterte, similar to the anti-Marcos struggle in the 80s.
Right.
But as we've seen, none of them really broke through.
Yeah.
And I wanted to know generally, like, why exactly did this opposition, which has like a pretty unified message, couldn't find a way to break through any of the seats in the Senate?
I think the answer lies precisely with how you frame the question. It's rehashing the debate of the democracy versus dictatorship framing, the Marcos versus the Yellows, which is the Liberal Party behind the Ocho Derecho slate. So straight eight is how it's called in English. And I think that's the problem. For this particular political moment, we can't rehash that same old debate because it doesn't resonate anymore. It's a different world in which we live. And as much as I support the language of human rights, as much as I support the language of defending liberal freedoms, the way the vocabulary that's being used somehow is very distant. It's very elitist. And I think that's part of the reason why the message didn't really register to a lot of voters. It feels like I'm not part of that narrative. I want to be part of the narrative of a country that can hold its head up high with a president that's kind of restoring esteem to the people. What I find interesting, where Ocho Derecho did not succeed, was their rhetoric against China. They thought that by mobilizing people against this foreign invader, they'd be able to make a good critique to President Duterte. And I'm kind of interested why that did not particularly register. And people are still willing to throw their support behind the president, who enjoys an 80% satisfaction rating. That's the highest any president post-EDSA, post-1986. No other president has matched that. So that's pretty phenomenal. And I think a lot of my work has to do with that, just unpacking what is behind that popularity. There's so much to say about this, but the headline really is, it's very complex. It's so multi-layered. There's not one answer to that question.
Yeah. Based on what you said, you think it's fair to say that given that Duterte's success in the midterms and his unprecedented high approval ratings on some form mean an explicit approval from the general public regarding his war on drugs, regarding his stance on China, and regarding his authoritarian tendencies.
Right. So I think this is where polling data becomes very helpful. Because if we just stick to polling data that says the president enjoys a very high satisfaction rating, then there is indeed this impression that you have this huge mass of Filipinos who are just manipulated and enamored by this demagogue. That's not true. Because if we look at other polling data, it goes to show that Filipinos have different views when it comes to different issues that don't necessarily reflect the president's position. So take the example of China. China still suffers from a negative trust rating for majority of Filipinos, much, much lower than the United States and Japan. When people were polled about whether the government is doing enough to protect its fishermen against Chinese invasion in no longer contested territories, because this is Philippine territory, a majority said, no, we have to defend our territory, and they feel like the government is not doing enough. If we look at polling data on the drug war, majority say, yes, we like the drug war, but if you ask them about the killings, they would say, no, we don't like the killings. So I think we have to emphasize these nuances, because if we just try to assume that everyone just supports the president, we miss something. And it's also very misleading, and it only serves to benefit the strongman if we think in that manner. So I think what we have to emphasize and celebrate here is that this support for the president is conditional. It's based on different calculations, and it doesn't mean that just because the president thinks this, the rest of the population thinks the same way. It's not the case.
Yeah. It seems like there's two kinds of perceptions of Duterte on an international level. You have the understanding that Duterte is this beloved punisher who is willing to stand up for the lower classes, for people of Mindanao, and is willing to stand up against imperial imposition. You know, he brought back the Balangiga belts from the United States. He told Canada to take back his trash, and now he's going up against the UN. We also have this perspective of Duterte as this mass murderer who's willing to disregard human rights, disregard democracy, kind of get his way. And why is it on an international scale people are able to grab onto the idea of him as a potential autocrat, but in the Philippine public, it's not exactly as unified?
Yeah, I think the answer to that question is that dictators are very complex beings. He is simultaneously this compassionate man who brought home distressed overseas Filipino workers from Saudi Arabia and brought them back to the Philippines. And that is a big deal, because for the longest time, Filipino migrant workers are perceived as oppressed overseas. But then this is the same man who would murder his own people in his own country, right? So there's many different facets to this man. And so if you ask me personally, not as a sociologist, but as a citizen of the Philippines, I did cheer him on when he insisted to bring back the Balangiga bells. But we have to also draw the line that there are some non-negotiables here. Like when you start murdering your own people, then that's not a non-negotiable for me. But I think the complexity of what you mentioned about how the media portrays President Duterte is just reflective of the broader debate about where the world is at the moment. So on the one hand, you have strongmen like Trump, Putin, Erdogan, Viktor Orban, who are kind of defending these illiberal practices. And then there's kind of counterpunch with a more liberal tradition. So in a way, the Philippines is not exotic or unique in this regard, right? And also just to add that when we talk about, for example, Duterte's performance on the international stage, these are old debates. When he says that, you know, the ICC is irrelevant, it has no right to come to the Philippines, that's an old debate in the sense that some post-colonial scholars are actually saying, yeah, look at the ICC. The only people they're pursuing are African warlords. Whatever happened to people who bombed Iraq or kind of messed Syria up, right? So that's a live debate. And I think what sets this current political moment apart is that these men like Duterte have allies on a global scale. and his behavior is being normalized by other strong men around the world. So that to me is very, very bothersome, but it also just surfaces long held anxieties that a lot of people harbor around the world.
Do you see him as a legitimate threat to the Philippine democracy? Or in other words, is this authoritarian threat in the Philippines in particular real?
I think it's real. The one of the work of my colleague Lee Morgan Besser calls this sophisticated authoritarianism. We're no longer just seeing authoritarian leaders who use, let's say, the military or the police just to intimidate or kill people. What's more disturbing about Duterte is how he uses the language of democracy to subvert it. So, for example, if we look at how he jailed members of the opposition or threatened to jail members of the opposition or shut down Rappler, an independent media organization, if you look at the rhetoric, they use the language of democracy. They use the language of rule of law to justify all of these attacks against democracy. So I think while it's important to kind of feel threatened by the more overt ways in which he attacks our liberal values and the way he attacks human rights, what's worth monitoring are the more insidious ways he attacks these institutions and how he's able to cover his tracks on how, for example, he can actually say to the International Criminal Court that, no, of course our judges are able to try erring policemen. Of course, some policemen have gone to jail because of their abuses in the drug war. He's able to do that. So there's this navigation of, no, we're following the rule of law. But they're using that language to subvert it. And I think that's what sets him apart compared to previous authoritarians like Marcos and other authoritarians in the region. It's a bit more sophisticated.
Situating Duterte in the long term, he's term limited as it is. And in 2022, he has to bow. Do you see that kind of process going quietly, or are you the kind of person that's pessimistic and think Duterte is heading towards kind of a long-term hold on power?
Yeah, so I'm not trained in the tradition of political science or sociology that can make predictions, and I've learned my lesson. I've lost bets in 2016 saying, this man will never be president. So a lot of it is actually hinged on how the opposition gets its act together. There's always this emphasis on how democracies are defined by the regimes in power. So all the attention is now on Duterte. But if we actually look at the literature on comparative authoritarianism, what ends a dictator's tenure are people within the regime, whether there are people within his regime that would challenge him, or whether the opposition gets its act together. And by opposition, I'm not talking about the political party as an opposition. I'm talking about mass movements, the public. So here I draw inspiration from Hong Kong, for example. You have a spontaneous mobilization of young and old people who are able to say no to Beijing. Istanbul is another good example of how the opposition, despite all of their differences, just came together to win the seat back of mayor in Istanbul. So I think that is what will define the next few years. We sort of know the game plan of this regime already. They want to concentrate power in the center. So we can't do anything about that. That's their problem. But what can we do as people outside the state who don't like what's going on? How can we get our act together? And I think that's what will spell the difference for the next few years.
So what do you think is the narrative that's going to come in the next couple of years regarding Duterte and the opposition?
Again, I will not make predictions, but I'm a big fan of normative theory. So I think if you ask me, what do I want to see? What is my ideal scenario? My ideal scenario will be people held into account formally. People are tried, put to jail, abuses, excesses will be exposed, and there will be a reckoning. So I think there has to be at some point where justice will be served. I'm not particularly sure if it has to reach to the level of the International Criminal Court. Personally, I don't want that to happen because that means our courts here have failed. So I would like to see our own courts try whoever made mistakes in this regime in the same way that I have the same expectations from previous regimes, all the corruption, all the excesses should have been processed here because ideally we have rule of law. So I'm not going to make predictions, but that's my ideal. There will be a day of reckoning. Everyone will get their day in court and there will be closure. So I think that matters.
Nicole, thank you so much.
Yeah, thank you.
Really appreciate it.
Cheers.
And if you enjoyed that episode, please remember to follow us on Spotify, Podbean, or wherever else you listen to your podcasts. Thanks for listening.